Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about pediculosis, a.k.a. head lice. They're more common than ever in Massachusetts schools. More school nurses, more parents, and let's not forget those little twitchy, itchy kids have to deal with them. But what's really the best treatment for getting rid of them? Should kids with lice be even allowed in school? And have you heard yourself sighing, "Oh, no," when you recently saw your child scratching his or her scalp? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now are three individuals who deal with lice far more than any of the rest of us. They are experts in this issue. Deborah Altshuler is president and co-founder of the National Pediculosis Association. It's based right here in Newton. Deborah Altshuler, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is Helen Hadley. You heard about her from Carrie Goldberg. She's the founder of The Nitpicker, a Needham-based private lice removal service. Helen Hadley, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And with us on the phone is Richard Pollack. He's president of Identify Us, a pest identification service, as well as a member of the biology faculty at Boston University. Richard Pollack, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon.
So, Helen Hadley, let me just start with you, because I think the thing that probably most parents who are listening to this right now, the number one thing they want to know is if their children come down with a case of lice, how would you recommend that they treat it?
I think that right now, I know from my own experience and thousands of customers' experiences that the chemicals are not very productive. I think very good knit comb and a lot of time. So, a lot of people do not have time these days, but there's no fast route anymore to get to the other side of it.
Does that mean that you wouldn't recommend any of the shampoos and that people should just skip that step altogether and go through strand by strand of their child's hair?
I don't judge people who use it. I tell people I don't think it's particularly effective, but that's between you and your physician because I don't have medical malpractice. There are some people this is very dangerous for, okay. And I don't want to be responsible. So I don't get involved in that with customers. Mm-hmm. I do urge them, no matter what they try, they still have to comb out eggs.
And when you say dangerous, I suppose you mean the potential chemicals in some of the...
it's for some people, it's... with certain medical conditions, it's not advisable.
Okay. Well, regardless, it sounds like no matter what you do, it's going to be an investment of time and effort.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Deborah Altshuler and Richard Pollack, if I can just turn just briefly with the similar question to you, your sort of basic recommendation for parents. I mean, Deborah, do you like the idea of the shampoos that are available?
Not at all, actually. I think that the FDA, in its own approval of the products, made it abundantly clear that they cannot be relied upon to be 100% effective, which is why when you buy one treatment, you actually get two applications. And this means that the children are going to be exposed because the eggs that are not killed are going to hatch. So the best idea, going along with what Helen does, is let's get those eggs out and avoid unnecessary exposure to any pesticides. Richard, so it's a known fact.
Richard Pollack, your thought?
Well, a couple things here. The products that are FDA approved actually have a vast amount of data behind them on efficacy and safety. It's true that none of them are necessarily 100% effective, but nothing is 100% effective in life. But they can be effective if used properly, and if used properly, they should offer much more benefit than risk. I think that those who are afraid of the chemicals just don't understand the basic toxicology of the situation. And then also the issue of the eggs. I think that too is exaggerated. One does not need to remove all of the eggs to eliminate a louse infestation.
Really? Because that seems to be totally counterintuitive to me.
It may be counterintuitive, but that's the science and the public health behind it. The vast majority of objects that people believe to be head louse eggs, or these things are called nits, are not. And of those that are head louse eggs, the vast majority have already hatched or are non-viable. So they're merely relics. There's no reason scientifically or medically to remove them. If you want to take them out for cosmetic purposes, well, more power to you.
Let me get a response from Deborah Altshuler on that.
I've never seen any science to support any of that. It's Mother Nature's biology to let the egg be the way in which she continues the infestation that protects the louse.
Okay. You know, I understand that there's you and Richard Pollack do stand on sort of opposite poles when it comes to your views about what the best way to treat lice is. And I actually kind of want to investigate that a little bit more, specifically in terms of what schools and parents should think about when it comes to, you know, sending children back to school who have a case of lice, for example. Because earlier we heard Carrie Goldberg mention that some schools have a no-nit policy, that children who have lice should not be allowed to come back to school until every last one of those nits is removed from their scalp. So Deborah Altshuler, you support that policy, is that right?
Well, it's abundantly important to clarify that all no-nit policies are not the same. It's used as a generic term, but the differences in policies vary from school to school. In one school, it can be one simple sentence. If your child is found to have lice or nits, they're going to go home. In terms of the NPA's policy, which frankly seldom gets quoted, we're all about being proactive and preventive. Carrie's story is classic for someone who really didn't have the information in advance. And while Mr. Pollack may be focusing on the lice and their nits and their behavior, we're more focused on what's in the best interest of the children. And the best interest for the children and the parents is to be proactive. Otherwise, anything else becomes crisis intervention. And that's when children are at risk of unnecessary exposure to pesticides. That we do have data that we've submitted to the government that is quite compelling in terms of the risks that are involved. Some children have had seizure disorders develop, and a long list of ailments that actually match what the government already has on record to be a risk with the products.
Richard Pollack, your take on whatever variations there are of a no-nit policy?
I think the no-nit policies are absolutely bankrupt. They're fatally flawed. They've never been demonstrated to have any effect on reducing the incidence or prevalence of head lice in schools or elsewhere. Medically, biologically, they have absolutely no basis, in fact. It's an emotional issue, and it also turns into a legal one as well. Children are losing a phenomenal amount of time from school, and the vast majority of kids sent home because of the no-nit policies that Deborah advocates for, the vast majority of those kids don't have lice. So you're more likely to be essentially punished or criminalized because someone who doesn't have proper training has labeled your child as lousy.
Well, I've got a ton, Mr. Pollack, I'm sorry to interrupt there, but there are so many listeners who want to give us some of their thoughts and their personal experience on this. So let me turn to them. Allison is calling from Newburyport. Allison, you're on the air.
Hang on. I was just so impressed with the other woman speaking, saying that full disclosure is so important. 4 years ago, my kids both came down with a mild case, luckily, but the family where it started, I believe, did not mention it to any of us, and my immediate response to my children's horrification was to call everybody they had had contact with and just give them a heads up. And the other piece of that for me was that I think it's totally humiliating and you know, upsetting to the kids to treat it like it's this big, dirty secret when nobody who I know who has had lice indeed has a dirty house or dirty children. And so I think that it's really, we're role modeling for our children when we just say this is the responsible thing to do.
Allison, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Woburn and hear from Meg. Meg, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say about 40 years ago, My niece was coming home from kindergarten. She got off the bus, and she said to her, gave her mother a note, and it said that there was head lice in the school. I just came down to visit my sister, and I said, Jean, I'll see you in a week. I was, like, petrified. My daughter, her children have had lice, and, well, when it happens, but it is, people don't know it. And all I can say is all these chemicals people use, you can still get it. A nice person gets it. And it's embarrassing, but you got to go on. But rosemary mint spray is a natural product. You put on your kids before they go to school, you'll feel a lot better. Rosemary mint spray. And
Meg, thank you so much. I'm sorry to cut you off there, but thank you so much for your call. Helen Hadley, founder of The Nitpicker, let me ask you, we've just heard people saying, you know, I know that anybody can get it, but it's still, I was paranoid when I did or heard about it. When people first come to you, what advice do you give them on how to deal with the social impact of having lice?
I'm much more of a listener than a talker. I'm not a researcher, so I really listen to what thousands of families or individuals have said to me about their experience.
And what have they told you?
It's all over the place. It's the whole gamut. So some people would rather not have a no-nit policy because they want to be able to go to work and pretend like this doesn't exist, and it's the opposite. Other people are, you know, why am I being responsible and taking care of this with my family, but then I'm afraid for my child to go back to school because I know it's there and nobody's paying attention.
Deborah Altshuler, do you recommend that parents tell everybody that they know, or should they just tell the school? Should they call up all their friends, you know, playmates' parents?
Well,
How large is the circle of information here?
I think, again, going back to the no-nit policy and the individual schools, that you have to be flexible with your policy, and parents and the PTA and the school administrators all need to come together and communicate well in advance of an outbreak and decide what works best for their community and what they're comfortable with. The recommendation of a no-nit policy puts everything in front of ever dismissing a child because they're infested. It gives everyone, a genuine no-nit policy, as NPA has. It gives everyone the opportunity to get it right without embarrassment, without panic, without being surprised, without using products that they didn't understand could be dangerous. The whole message of the NPA's no-nit policy is to be proactive with early detection. And even when Helen, thank goodness there are people like her that are available for the 200 and some nits, but if you're well aware in advance and you know to screen regularly, you're going to detect it early and it's not going to be a big deal in your family.
Richard Pollack, this is a question that's been on my mind all day. We're hearing that the number of cases of lice is growing quite a bit. Carrie Goldberg told me earlier today that when she told her school nurse, the nurse was like, oh yeah, it's all over the place. Are we seeing an increase in incidence of lice? Are they spreading for any particular reason?
We're seeing an epidemic, but it's not an epidemic of lice. It's an epidemic of hysteria. I keep hearing...
but on the other hand, we're seeing, you know, an epidemic of bed bugs, and that's a true spreading of those insects.
Well, that's a different story altogether. Bed bugs, too, have problems in terms of... some level of exaggeration of their importance and spread. But let's focus on head lice. I'm hearing a lot about responsibility and the right thing to do and this and that. This has been examined very, very carefully by physicians, public health people, scientists, researchers. I would urge your listeners to look at what's been written about this. Go to sources such as the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Association of School Nurses, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They all now dissuade against these anti-louse and anti-nit policies, and they explain why. If you want to live in an emotional state and do what's intuitive, even though there's no basis for that, fine. But if you want to base your actions on what do we actually know in terms of science, do your homework. And if you read the stuff with an open mind, you may say, huh, I didn't understand that. I didn't realize that. A lot of my preconceived notions are wrong.
Well, we've just got a minute here before we have to wrap up this segment, and I'd like to turn the last question to Helen Hadley. Because
I would just like to jump in a minute as listening to that, and I'm not a researcher, but I've been seeing this a lot. When you have a patient or a customer of ours with 7,000 nits and 400 bugs, which is one case we did a couple years ago, another person with well over 10,000 nits, you can't say. And they've all used many products, many, many products. And they've not worked. So that's proof that's not in a lab, but it's in somebody's home and head. So I just don't quite understand why the whole notion that we should sit back and avoid dealing with this doesn't make sense to me at all.
Well, Helen Hadley, founder of The Nitpicker, I'm afraid that's actually all the time we have for this conversation, okay. Even though there's obviously so much more to talk about. Thank you so very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Richard Pollack, president of Identify Us, a pest identification service, and associate professor of biology at Boston University, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Deborah Altshuler, president and co-founder of the National Pediculosis Association based in Newton, thank you as well. There's terrific information about this in the four-part series on WBUR's Common Health blog. That's commonhealth.wbur.org.
And now it's time for your letters.
You know, Anthony, ever since I became a mom, I've let the mail at my house pile up into these terrifying heaps because it's just all credit cards
and bills.
So the Radio Boston mail, I'm so glad we're looking at it. It is so much more enjoyable to sort through.
Yes, and there isn't a single letter from that new baby industrial complex.
No.
So here we go. We got a lot of mail this week, including from several of our listeners who are mothers. They responded to our segment that examined the medical and ethical concerns of a new blood test that can detect Down syndrome earlier in pregnancy than ever before.
Letitia Velasquez, she's a freelance writer who listens to Radio Boston online from her home in Canterbury, Connecticut. Her daughter has Down syndrome.
Most women, when they're faced with a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome, don't have very much information about what it's like to raise a child with Down syndrome. So it's very difficult to make such an important life decision without informed consent.
Letitia says 8 years ago she refused prenatal testing on her own daughter because she says she would never consider abortion.
Whereas on our website, wbur.org/Boston, Melissa Barup wrote that she fully supports an early detection test. She writes, "A friend of mine has a little boy with Down syndrome. He had years of physical therapy, occupational therapy, along with attending a special school for children with Down syndrome. This took a lot of planning, support, and money, which luckily they had. Not everyone has this. To be given the option of terminating early, especially for those completely unable to provide such support, or to have 7 or 8 months of pregnancy to find the specialist and set up the care plan is a blessing."
On Tuesday, we talked about MIT's high hopes to transform drab Kendall Square into a buzzing new retail and housing hub. Our conversation launched a lively urban planning debate online.
Connor Clockwise chimed in that MIT's plan, quote, reeks of spin. Proposals from people who want to get something done by code variances, yet want no input from residents and have no plans for more future residents.
On the other hand, Dana Peters wrote, "There are definitely some positive aspects to MIT's plan. For those of us who already work in Kendall Square, there are no places to run errands at lunch and not many options for meeting up with friends or having a drink with coworkers at the end of the day." Peters is not sure if MIT can pull it off, but she says, "Since most of the land in that section of Kendall Square is already a wasteland of ugly buildings and parking lots, they should be given a chance to try."
And on Wednesday, we chatted with four young Boston-based Egyptians about their families and the incredible scenes of protest and violence we've been seeing in Cairo. Many of you loved hearing from these young people. Here's Audrey Beckany from Jamaica Plain.
I've been watching a lot of coverage, and there are a lot of academics and policy analysts and talking heads going on and on about what's going on in Egypt. And it felt really refreshing to hear from, first of all, young people, and also people who have personal investment in the place and what's going on there, and hear how it affects them.
And you really could hear how much it's affecting them, even though they're here in Boston. And there was something that one of our guests, Habib El Magrisi, said that grabbed a lot of people's attention.
"I ran it past my parents and I was shot down, but I hope they're not listening right now, because I'm seriously considering buying a plane ticket and just showing up in Cairo Airport."
Get your ticket and go back. That's what listener Hannah wrote on our website. She added, "I came to the U.S. from what was then communist Czechoslovakia, just before the Berlin Wall came down and the Velvet Revolution happened. I did not go back right away, missed it all, and always regretted it. Good luck."
Well, we always enjoy hearing from you, so please post your comments online at wbur.org/Boston or through Facebook or Twitter at Radio Boston, or you can leave a message on our listener line, 617-353-1137. Again, 617-353-1137.